you believe that the children were sent into the killer's arms? I don't either. And yet that's the thesis that a non-scholar by the name of Arthur Kessler tried to propound in a book which has gotten far more attention than it deserves, called The 13th Christ. I'd like to deal with the 13th tribe. It's ours.
And with the myth of race, and with questions of our origin, because the issues have an intrinsic value of their own. So we like to know where we come from and who we are. Where we come from, to a certain degree, determines who we are.
I'd like to begin by suggesting that making a myth, one of man's most beloved undertakings, we do it all the time. The study of this is a fascinating one, a disturbing one, because we find most of our myths in history and the record of what has been. Clearly, when we look for myths in history, we're looking not to history, but what it can tell us about human nature and human development, the human condition. Rather, we're looking to history for proof texts of what we already begin to believe, to reassure us that our assumptions and prejudices are in fact true. Now, having said that, let me suggest that I can tell you the day, the place, and the occasion in which a new myth about the Jewish people and about the state of Israel was launched.
The date was November 6th of 1976. The occasion was a meeting of an international conference on Zionism. Since that conference took place in Baghdad, you can be assured there were no Zionists there. The man who launched this myth was an American senator, Senator James Aburzek. Freshman Democratic senator from South Dakota, and the first man of Arab American descent to be elected to that high office. Since he has come to the Congress, Senator Aburzek has made it a major point to try and convince Washington that the treatment of the Middle East, of the Arab cause, by the American media has been anything but even-handed. And in trying on his own to right this imbalance, what he considers to be this imbalance, he has made himself a favorite of Arab American audiences, of audiences of right-wing, traditional anti-Semitic groups, and also of increasingly of audiences of American businessmen and bankers who are looking for a kind of theology which they might share with their new Arab customers. And not incidentally, in passing, Senator Aburzek has made himself quite an income from these lectures. In any case, on this particular day, before that particular dispassionate, unbiased audience, Senator Aburzek was emoting on his familiar themes when suddenly he added a new note, a new myth. He told the audience that after all, the Jews who settled in Israel had no claim to the land, no historic claim whatsoever, because they were not descendants of David and of Isaiah, of the ancient Israelites, but they were descendants of a Hunnish people, the Khazars, who had come out of the central steppes of Asia and who had never been in the Middle East until the late 1930s and 1940s. Now, I know that Senator Aburzek had never heard of the Khazars until a week or two before this speech. He would never have heard of the Khazars if it had not been for Kessler's book and the uncritical attention it received in the press. In any case, here was a new myth. the traditional Zionist interest in Palestine based upon the fact that we lived in that land for 1,200 years before the destruction of 70, that our ancestors were the first to create a nation out of that country, that it was the Holy Land to us. This has no meaning because the Eastern European Belu settlers, the early Zionists, came out of a world condition which was not genetically or historically tied to the Semites of old, but was in fact tied more to the peoples who, the nomadic peoples who came across the steppes of Central Asia. Now all this is of course errant nonsense and irrelevant. But it's interesting to think of the power of myth, and it's important to consider them because you'll hear this story now again and again. It'll become one of the coins of currencies of discussion, political and otherwise, in certain parts of the world. And Aburzek's new myth is a direct result of Kessler's attempt to launch a myth, in his case not a new one, because he borrowed it whole from a number of lesser-known scholars in the early part of the century. Essentially, what Kessler was attempting to do was to launch a myth. In this case, not a myth to disprove the traditional Zionist claims of historic interest by the Jewish people in the Holy Land, but rather Kessler's interest in showing that movement, which had culminated in the convulsions of our own century, was in fact a giant nightmare of joke. The Jews weren't Semites at all, and all of the attacks on Judaism and on Jews based on their supposed Semitism, on the fact that they were non-Aryan, was nothing more than a factor of historic misinformation. That the Jews were as Aryan, as barbarian as any other people who civilized Europe, and presumably, having said that, you have reduced to mockery and irrelevance the whole attack on Jews, Judaism, particularly the racial attack on Jews, which was launched in the middle of the 19th century by Eustace Chamberlain, Rabineau, and Richard Wagner, which culminated in the Nazi atrocities of our time. Now, who and what is Arthur Kessler? And why should Arthur be Kesslerly interested in this child? Arthur Kessler is a not unusual type among our people. Certainly not among the 20th century variety of Jews. He was born in Hungary. He was a very bright young man. He was born at a time in a world where the traditional culture of the Jew had broken apart, where the traditional cultural envelope of the Jew that a Jew assimilated, catered, yeshiva, was no longer part of his makeup, where he was launched in a world full of convulsive change, full of new ideologies, without spiritual rooting. A number of these Jews moved back and forth across Europe, affiliating themselves one way or another with every one of the cosmopolitan, radical, revolutionary movements of the day, passionately committing themselves, transferring the old messianism of Judaism into a new kind of social, socialistic, or political messianism. So we find Kessler in the middle 1920s in Palestine, attracted for the moment to the issue, to the kibbutz, becoming a pure experiment of the early settlers. But like so many of his particular psychological type, what he approves of in theory, he is not willing to necessarily involve himself in practice. He was a cafe socialist. But as he stayed in the cafes of Haifa rather than the fields of the gun, and as a result, he was looked upon by the early settlers as not very good or promising material. He began to develop a whole rationale of how these people were romantics and essentially irrelevant, and they were far too chauvinist, and distance grew between them, and after 3 years in the cafes of Haifa, he tired of that, and he went back to Europe. Europe involved himself in the Communist Party. became during the 1930s a propagandist for the communists, very much involved in the new revolution, the Great Hope. And then after the trials of Stalin, the purges in the late 1930s, he renounced the party. They had abandoned him because they had become something less than what he expected. And he then proceeded to involve himself as a participant observer in the Spanish Civil War. He was finally captured by Franco and jailed for a period of time. Then he went to participate in the Second World War, always somehow in the maelstrom, but not quite of it. Again, he was captured not by the Nazis, but by the Vichy French, and jailed for a while. And finally, he escaped to England, which he lived out the war, and he lived since. He moves from passion to passion. After the Second World War, he published a series of plays and novels and writing some of them about the best of his work. One of them called Darkness at Noon, a very powerful indictment of the brainwashing techniques of the communism. He was fascinated in the late 40s in the establishment of Israel. Went back to Palestine and wrote a book called Thieves in the Night, which was a kind of glorification of the guerrillas, the terrorists, the Irgun and the Stern Gang, the cult of the gun. And
then after Israel was established, he proved once again he couldn't stay as part of an ongoing society, because he began by publishing a document which was a kind of apologia. First, a document called The God That Failed, his experiences in which he removed himself from the Communist Party and why he had done so. And then a manifesto about his Jewishness, in which he said that after 1948, there were only two choices for a Jew: either Aliyah, immigration to the Holy Land, or cosmopolitanism, a complete renunciation of Judaism. Judaism had no reason and no ability to survive in the diaspora, and for him, a diaspora Jew, there was nothing but to put his Judaism behind him, whatever it had been, and to live as a cosmopolitan, a member of the international community of letters and of hope. And he spent the last years during his, when he's 50 and in his 60s, he's now a man of 72, in England, writing on almost every subject under the sun. He wrote a biography of Kepler, he wrote another biography of Newton, he wrote a biography of Galileo. He wrote a history of the act of creative consciousness. He wrote a history of Eastern mysticism. And now he has taken the plunge into the history of the Jewish people with this book, The 13th Tribe. A man with these varied interests may have a number of insights about many of these fields. He certainly is able to do his homework. But he remains always the College Southmore, who must depend upon other people's works. And as he's a, you know, he lives by his writing, he obviously looks to those things which will be saleable and which will be attractive, and he has a tendency to go way beyond where scholars would ever dare to go in order to make a thesis that will prove attractive, which will sell, as in fact this book has. Now, who are these Khazars that Kessler has fastened upon? And are they purely an invention of his? And are there, in fact, Huns in our Jewish background? The answer, of course, is yes, there are. There are Huns, and they're Chinese, and they're Negroes, and they're Semites. They're people from all races and all peoples ever inhabited the face of the globe. We've always had conversion. We've always had intermarriage. Jews have found themselves in far distant places, and some have been attracted to Judaism, even as some Jews have been attracted to other traditions. What about these Khazars? Are they, in fact, something that Kessler has discovered on his own? Of course not. Every Jew who has any pretense to Jewish literacy since the 12th century is known about the Khazars. Because one of the greatest of the medieval pieces of literature, a great philosophic work by Judah Halevi, was called by the name of the Khazars, the Khuzari, or the Book of the Khazars. Judah Halevi was the poet laureate of the golden age of the Jews in Spain. He was a man of a great poetic vision, a scholar, biblical and Talmudic. Many of the hymns of the synagogue are from his pen. And around the year 1140, Judah Halevi wrote in Arabic for his friends a philosophic dialogue, which was based on an historical premise. And the premise was that 400 years before, in 740 of the Common Era, the king of the Khazars had decided that the old shamanism of his ancestral folk was no longer viable for him and for his people. And he had summoned to his court a Muslim thinker, an imam, a monk, a Christian, and a chacham, a Jewish sage. And these three men had debated before the king the relative merits and claims of their traditions. And then the king had made his choice between the three great faces of the then known civilization, and he had chosen to become a Jew. Halevi subtitles the Khuzari, a book of beliefs and opinions in defense of the despised faith. Judaism was a minority faith both in the world of Islam and in Christendom. It was despised in each case by the majority, but in this historic case, Judaism had won the day, and around that historic peg, Halevi had woven his arguments. He makes no claim that this is exactly what was said. It simply provides him a dramatic vehicle with which to make his points. Now, obviously, Halevi assumed that this event had taken place and that his readers knew about it. And we know how information about the conversion of the Khazars came to the West. 200 years before Halevi, around 950 of the Common Era, just about 1,000 years ago, a fascinating Jew, Chasdai ben Isaac ibn Shaprut, was the chief physician and one of the major ministers of the Abbasid Caliph of Spain, Abd al-Rahman III. Abd al-Rahman ruled from Cordoba. He ruled a kingdom which included Spain and Portugal and most of North Africa. And Abd al-Rahman was a man of letters, and so was Chasdai ibn Shaprut. And Chasdai ibn Shaprut is the first great figure to emerge among Spanish Jews. He was a poet in his own right, as well as a statesman and a financier and a physician. And he was fascinated by literature and letters, and he was the man who brought to the West the Talmud and Talmudic scholars and Jewish grammarians and Jewish poets and established the basis of the Golden Age. Now, somewhere along the line, the various messengers whom Chasdai sent to the various capitals of the world in the service of his king met with a number of Khazars. Chasdai, in some correspondence, speaks of their having met Khazars in various ports of the Adriatic and in Constantinople. And they heard from these Khazar traders and Khazar ambassadors that the Khazars were, in fact, a Jewish kingdom which lived in the steppes of southern Russia, centered on a capital called Itil, which was built near the mouth of the Don River, that they lived in the land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, above Armenia in the Caucasus region of Russia, and that some 200 years before their day, the king had in fact converted to Judaism. And the correspondence, some correspondence still exists between Chasdai ibn Shaprut and Joseph, the king of the Khazars. Chasdai writes to Joseph around 950, "I have heard that you are king of this kingdom, that the kingdom is Jewish. In what do you trade? Where is your capital? How do you observe the Sabbath? Have you heard anything about the date of the coming of the Messiah?" The great issue of medieval times. And a return letter comes to Chasdai from Joseph, in which Joseph tells him that they were a nomadic people who settled in this area, that they now have a large empire which covers the headwaters of the Volga and of the Don rivers, most of the northern coast of the Black Sea and all of the land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, that they provide great service to the Byzantine emperor in Constantinople and the caliph in Baghdad, because they keep away from their kingdoms the Vikings, the Rus, the Norsemen, who are beginning to attack more of these people in a moment, that they trade in horses and in the silk of China and in other goods, that they observe the Sabbath, that they have rabbis and synagogues among them, and he makes no comment about the date of the coming of the Messiah, but he invites Chasdai as a minister to come and pay a state visit to his capital at Itil. And that's the end of the correspondence. But there is enough evidence from this correspondence and from the travel diaries and political correspondence of various Byzantine emperors and Arab travelers and Christian monks that the Khazars are an historic fact, that they were a major people among the steppe people of Central Asia, that they moved from east to west, that is, from the heartland of Asia above Tibet, eastward towards the what we call today Eastern Europe, the Slavic countries, someplace in the late 5th or early 6th century, that they were part of the rear guard of Attila's horde as he moved towards the west, that they fell away from the movement further west and settled in this area, that they established there a sizable area which they claimed as their own, that they began to form an empire, that they were ruled by men called Khagans, or kings. It was a dual form of monarchy. They had two kings, very much like Japan. They had a Mikado, a Khagan who was their ceremonial king in whom the office was personalized, the divinity was personalized, and he could be approached only by the senior ministers of state. And then they had another Khagan who was the man who administered the state, who carried out the various decisions from day to day. They were originally a tent people, a nomad people, a horse people, and finally they settled down and they established this empire. And they lived largely on the tolls that they were and taxes that they were able to extort from anybody who wanted to use the great waterways of Russia, because they controlled the mouths of these waterways as they flowed into the Black Sea and into the Caspian Sea. All the trade that went from north to south, and also the trade that went from west to east. And we know further that very shortly after the correspondence between Khasta ibn Shaprut and Yosef, king of the Khazars, that the kingdom began to suffer some reverses. And finally, by the 12th century, it disappears from the face of the earth. And these reverses were administered to them by Vikings, of all people. Now, we don't normally associate the Vikings with the Crimea, with the Black Sea area, with the steppes of Central Asia. But it's fascinating that between the 6th century and the 10th century, there were two great martial eruptions which changed the face of the world. One begins in the tip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. It's Islam. A small people who live in the Hejaz suddenly erupt, and within 100 years, they conquer all of the Near East, all of Northern Africa, the Iberian Peninsula. They're stopped by Charlemagne, you know, in southern France. They're stopped, interestingly, in a series of major battles by the Khazars in Armenia. Those are the two great defeats that the Arabs felt. And about 100 years later, you get an eruption of Norsemen, of Vikings, out of Norway and Sweden. And they find their way to England, Iceland, Greenland, to the United States. They become the basis of the Norman Kingdom of France. They move up all the waterways of Europe, and they actually destroy Amsterdam and Brussels and Paris and wipe these cities off the face of the earth. They've come along the Atlantic coast as far south as Central Africa, and they move down the river system of Russia, down the Dnieper and the Don and the Volga, and they begin to attack the Magyar area and then the Byzantine area, Constantinople, from the north. And the Khazars find themselves as a buffer between Islam and Greek Orthodox Byzantine Empire and these Vikings, or Varangians as they were called, or popularly the Rus. The Vikings are the Rus in the language of the Tatars and of the Khazars. They capture Kiev, the great city on the Dnieper, and they make Kiev their capital. They take it from the Khazars, and they begin to spread their influence in this area. And sometime in the 10th century, they convert to the Greek Orthodox faith, and the Rus become the basis of the Russian people whom we know today. Now, the Russian people then, strangely, are Vikings by basis. And the civilization has moved up towards the north. Now, let's look again at the Khazars, at this buffer kingdom. Why did it become Jewish? Well, there are many reasons, we think. We don't know. We have no Khazar material whatsoever to go on. But one reason seems diplomatic, to be clear and to be diplomatic. The Khazars live in this area of southern Russia. They now abut the great civilized areas of the world. The primitive shamanism, the animistic cults that they bring with them from Central Asia are primitive. And increasingly, their upper classes recognize this. They are trading and dealing constantly with Muslims, with Christians, and with Jews. They obviously want to become more civilized. And there obviously were missionaries from all of the faiths among them. But if the Khazars in their particular area become Greek Orthodox, Catholics, they will inevitably become culturally appendages, dependencies of the Byzantine Empire. And if they become Muslim, they will inevitably become appendages, dependencies of the caliph in Damascus, of the Muslim powers. And they will always inevitably have to commit themselves to one power or the other, and in the 8th century, it was not clear which power, if any, would become the dominant power in that part of the world. So it's easier to become something else, something civilized and something else. They become Jewish, which means that they are not either dependencies of Constantinople or of Baghdad or Damascus. There's an interesting parallel to this in modern times. About 30 years ago, I visited the Jewish club in Hong Kong. And I saw on the wall of this Jewish center two pictures. One of Herzl, Theodor Herzl, the great founder of Zionism, and the other a picture of Jabotinsky, the man who was the radical head of revisionist Zionism, who claimed not only Palestine, but Jordan and anything else that he could think of claiming for the Jews. And I asked somebody there why these two pictures of all the great leaders of Jewish life that might have been chosen. And the answer was interesting. When many of our ancestors came from Eastern Europe to the West, the founders of the Jewish communities of Harbin and Shanghai and of Hong Kong went Trans-Siberia to the East. And when they landed in Manchuria and they began to do business in the port towns, they found that all of the business was organized around a series of national clubs. There was a Russian club, and there was an English club, and there was a French club, and so on. But after the Russian Revolution, these clubs became centers of competing ideology as well as national centers. You now had a Russian club, which was the Communist Party, and you now had an English club, which was the Capitalist Party. And the Jews wanted to do business with both sides. Their livelihood depended on it. So it happened at this time that Jabotinsky was making a visit through that part of the world, and he preached Zionism to them, his brand of Zionism. They said, aha, you're right, and you're right. You're right, the Jewish people should have a state in Palestine, and you're right, we should have a Zionist club here in Harbin and another Zionist club here in Shanghai, because nobody can argue with us. The communists, we have socialist experiments in Palestine. The British, you have a mandate over Palestine. We can do business from a Zionist club base with either. That's essentially, I think, what happened in the 8th century in Khazaria. It made a determination to accept a monotheistic faith, and there must have been some kind of mystical experience, some kind of moment which confirmed their convictions. There's a report that when they made a raid into Armenia, to the Muslim land, they brought back among their spoil a great Jewish altar. It may have been a Taurus ark. Whatever it was a symbol to them of the appropriateness of this conversion. So there were Jewish Khazars, the descendants of the Huns. There were descendants of the Huns who were, in fact, Jews, and they were not insignificant people. For three or four centuries, they were a major power in our world. But to jump from that statement to the statement that Kessler makes in his book, that most of the Jews of Eastern Europe are lineal descendants of the Khazars, is to make a kind of historical jump which is totally incredible. He has hold here of a problem, however. How did the Jews get to Eastern Europe? The traditional argument is a fascinating one, and it shows you how history develops. European Jews are called Ashkenazim. Spanish Jews are called Sephardim. They're biblical words. Ashkenazi means German. And it's assumed since all European Jews were called German, that somehow Jews had moved in Europe from west to east, from the Rhineland to Germany, from Germany to Poland. How and when? Well, the answers were after the disruptions of the first, second, and third crusade, when the Jewish communities of the Rhineland were literally destroyed and the people had to flee. And after the great plagues of the 14th and 15th century, when again, Western Europe was to a large degree depopulated.
The problem here is the fact that, number one, there are not enough people in these displacements to have made for the large number, the hundreds of thousands of Jews who settled in Eastern Europe. And number two, the language of Eastern Europeans, Yiddish, shows almost no trace of influence of the German of the western parts of Europe. But German there comes from Bavaria, comes from Eastern Germany and the countries further to the east. So scholars have had a number of hypotheses that over the last 50 years that again recognize this problem of where Eastern European Jews came from. Because ours was one hypothesis. We put in circulation 50, 60 years ago and almost immediately shot down. Why was it shot down? Well, for a large number of reasons. We know that the Khazar nobility converted. We do not know that the average Khazar, the average member of the horde, in fact, became a Jew. And we think that the numbers who converted were probably limited to a very small upper class, not enough to account for the large number of Jews. We also do not know what variety of Judaism the Khazar converts had. Those Jews who survived somehow to the 18th century and 19th century in Eastern Europe, who still spoke the Turkish languages, the dialects of the Khazar, were all what we call Karaite Jews. That is, they were all Jews who denied the authority of the Talmud, who accepted the authority only of the Bible as interpreted through a series of their own idioms from the 8th and 9th century. Now, patently, the Jews of Eastern Europe were Talmudic, they were different Jews, not Karaite Jews. They might have been, probably would have been, had the Khazars been a dominant element. What seems to be the case is that most of the Jews of Eastern Europe come not from the Rhineland in Western Europe, they come not from these Khazar converts, but come very ordinarily and prosaically from the Black Sea areas, early as the 3rd and 4th century BC, up along the Danube River, which is a great highway in that part of the world. Trading, farming. But they come up along the Aegean and Adriatic seas, establish themselves in Yugoslavia and Italy, move across the mountain passes into what is Austria, and from Austria into Poland. The movement is largely anonymous. The last 3 or 4 centuries, they're attracted by new trading opportunities, by the cutting down of the forests of Europe, by the repopulation of Europe, by the need of Europe for people. It's always attractive to immigrants, the opportunity to go along with pioneering, to move into Europe in these rather anonymous but very basic ways, that they are in fact part of the traditional people who are in the mainstream of our community. Now, whether this be the final answer or not, it's clearly arrant nonsense to speak of the Jews as somehow, of Eastern Europe, the European Jews, as somehow being the lineal descendants of Huns. It's in fact arrant nonsense to speak of the Jews as being racially of any one stock. And I think this is the critical. I would have thought that after we had finally laid the lie to all the racist nonsense of Hitler, these kinds of myths would not have emerged again. Did we not finally make clear to the world that there were Jews China, who had every one of the features of the traditional Chinese, traditional Mongol. There's a fascinating Passover prayer book in the rare book of Green Tower. It comes from the 13th to 14th to 15th century Jewish community along the trade route from China near the mouth of the Yellow River, a little town called Taipung Fu.
What you see in this book is a very delightful series of illustrations of the Jews leaving in Egypt. Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt. And there's Moses, black hair, pulled back, the pigtail, slant eyes, leading a group of Chinese, you know, out of Egypt, out of infantry. If you've gone to India 20 years ago, you would found a group of brown Jews living below Madras on the coast. Jews who were probably part of the new Davidian group, who had been pushed down by Aryan invaders some 2-3 millennia ago, and who were converted to Judaism probably 1,500 years ago. If you go to Ethiopia today, you would find black Jews, the Falashas, who lived in that part of the world as Jews for 2,200 years. There is no Jewish body type. Racially, we are not of any one stock, because we have had converts and intermarriages over long centuries in great numbers. Indeed, it was only during the locked-in years, the ghetto years, the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries in Europe, that the Jewish group began to almost universally marry among themselves, and during years the Muslims could not convert other Jews. And yet these myths survive in a book like Kessler's itself, and it's reviewed these things. This is what's disturbing. The New York Times, certainly not a traditional center of anti-Semitic propaganda, assigned this book to a certain otherwise unknown Jewish scholar, the name of Fitzroy McLean. Now, Fitzroy McLean has to his credit, according to the little tag at the bottom of the article, a major work entitled A Concise History of Scotland, which qualifies him completely to review a history of the Jewish people. It turns out also that he's made one visit to the mountain people of southern Russia. I looked him up. He's a nearly 80-year-old former professor of English, was no knowledge by his biography of Turkish languages or cultures of that part of the world. He's obviously a traveler and now interested in it. But listen to the terms, the racial terms, in which this review is cast. He's reviewing here Kessler's thesis. Though Turkish by race, the Khazars almost certainly remain Jews, greatly outnumbering the racially Jewish Jews, reach these areas by other routes and other periods of history. And this is what followed first. Racially, the great majority of Eastern Europeans were not Jews at all, the Turco-Khazars. And second, that as most Western Jews came from Eastern Europe, most of them are not Jews either. And in fact, there are probably very few truly Semitic Jews in Europe. That's the language of Germany in the 1930s. I don't know if Fitzroy McLean is an anti-Semitic enough thing. He's obviously been conditioned by this assumption that Jews are somehow genetically different from all people. This comes in part from a number of problems. The first, the fact that during the ghetto years we were locked in and locked away and prohibited from intermarriage and conversion. And secondly, that Christians find it difficult to understand that over the centuries, large numbers of people would in fact convert to Judaism. Missionarism and conversion to Christianity are taken as synonymous with the idea that large numbers of people would in fact want to convert to Judaism, is many of them outlandish. And third of all, we're different. The very fact of our difference in their eyes establishes us as somehow racially different. It's easier to say, they don't believe in the Christ, or they don't believe in what we believe in because they are racially different, than it is to say they don't believe in what we believe in because they find it unbelievable. It would be a very hard position for you to accept different factors of person. Well, there you have the 13th tribe that existed, and so did the 14th tribe, the 15th tribe, and the 16th tribe. We were part of those peoples who inhabited southern Russia in the early centuries. We did make a major contribution to the civilization of
that particular group of people. There may be some evidence of cultural assimilation through the Khazars and elements of the Jewish culture into the Russian culture. A number of the letters of the Cyrillic, the Russian alphabet, seem to be taken from the Hebrew alphabet. And we do know that in the 14th and 15th century, the new Russian court, there was, for a period of time, some breaking interest in what was called a Judaizing heresy. We know very little about it because all the records have been destroyed. But a number of the early czars and their ministers were fascinated by Judaism. It may have been that there was some kind of lingering Jewish community, Jewish culture in that part of the world, which did have an impact upon it. But of this whole brouhaha over this little book, as any good thing that we still have a job to do with many of our friends and neighbors. Tell them that the Jewish people exist. The Jewish people consist of all those who, for whatever reason, want to involve themselves in our culture, in our faith, in our values, in our concerns, political, social, and otherwise. There is not one group that is closed to anyone who wants to join. They want to see about conversion, they want to contact Rabbi Silver.